Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. Governor Brown has recognized this driest winter in California history by declaring a drought emergency. The Sierra snowpack is at 15% of its annual average, and that could leave Central Valley farmers with no allocation from water districts at all. Here's peach farmer Troy Regeer.
There's a chance this year we might get none. And that means more pumping, and like I say, the pumps are pumping less because the water table is going down, and it's scary because you have to go deeper, and the pump guys are already, there's already wells going dry last year, so if you're not in a good location that has a good access to your aquifer, you know, the depth, you have to go deeper, then you could be on a waiting list, and you can lose a lot of trees and fruit.
Dawn Cantor runs the Florabella Farm west of Visalia.
We're doing everything we can to use less water. We took out probably 40 or 50 apple trees because they take too much water. We've never seen anything like this, and we're scared, we're nervous, we do not know what our future is.
Jeffrey Keitlinger is general manager of the Metropolitan Water District, which supplies water for most of Southern California. Good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren. Thank you.
Assess the situation, if you will, statewide before we start talking just about MWD jurisdiction.
Sure. It's extremely tough. I've never seen a year like this. 2013, the calendar year, driest year ever recorded, and normally we start to rain, and so this January, again, nothing. So we're already halfway through this year's winter season for 2014, November, December, January, the three of the four or five wettest months, and we've had virtually no rain whatsoever. So we're shaping up very bleak for 2014.
Turning to the Central Valley once again, where there's a $45 billion agriculture industry, 80% of the water in California goes to agriculture. What does it mean when the snowpack is 15%?
It means there will be very little water available for farming this year. So we have allocations, and right now the State Water Project is providing 5% of the water people count on. So normally they like to be somewhere between 50 and 100, meaning you can do full planting. When you're at 5%, very limited options. You're going to see a lot of fallowing of crops, empty fields and stumping of older orchards. It's going to be very bleak in the Central Valley.
Where does your organization, the MWD, get the water, and is there enough?
Now, for Southern California, Metropolitan provides a little more than half the water to all of Southern California. The rest is mostly what we call local water from the local groundwater basins in Southern California and our local rainfall. We get the water from...
And the Department of Water and Power for the city of Los Angeles, which gets it from the Owens Valley.
Correct. They get a portion from the Owens Valley. Now, that's been very, very low this year. So Los Angeles Department of Water and Power has had to get most of their water from Metropolitan. Almost three-quarters of their water will be provided by Metropolitan this year. And we get our water from two main places, Northern California and the Colorado River. So when it's very dry in Northern California, as it is right now, that puts a pressure on Metropolitan supplies as well.
But you've indicated that there is enough.
Yes, but that's because we've invested billions and billions of dollars here. You never drought-proof a region, but we plan for multi-dry years. And so we have been steadily asking Southern Californians to conserve. Every year we fund at least $40 million a year towards conservation rebate types programs. We've been doing this for the last two decades, and so we've steadily lowered the demand for water throughout Southern California so that it's a much more manageable amount than it was in 1980. And then on top of that, we built storage. We have large supplies of water stored throughout California, throughout the West, but also right here in Southern California to help us with these dry years so we can pull on that water behind our reservoirs.
What more is needed if this is going to continue for a long time, which appears to be the case?
Well, we're going to need two things. The governor has called for everybody to do what they can to reduce water demand, and so we're going to need all Californians. Governor laid out a goal of 20%. Here in Southern California, we're actually already are down 20% over the last 20 years, but we're going to ask folks in Southern California to do more, to do what they can to conserve water. That's the easiest, simplest thing you can do in the short term. in the long term, we're going to have to reinvest in our infrastructure, just like Metropolitan's done in Southern California, building new reservoirs, building new pipeline systems to move water around. We need this governor's Bay Delta Conservation Plan to go forward, and then we're going to have to build some more storage for our growing state.
There's a lot of indication that there's political opposition to the reservoirs, the pipelines you're talking about, and particularly to the Bay Delta plan with those massive tunnels that the governor is talking about. How do you plan to build public support for it?
It's going to be difficult. There is no doubt about it. Any time you involve water in California, it's always controversial. But things that need to be invested in need to be done. Many things are controversial, transportation, new jobs, but we need to make these investments. We did it here in Southern California. It's why we're not suffering terribly from this drought. I do hope that there is some short-term benefit from a drought like this, that it does wake people up to the fact you need to invest in our infrastructure.
But certainly with the Bay Delta plan particularly, there are trade-offs, are there not, to protect, for the environment, for the fisheries, for various things?
There are indeed trade-offs, which is also why it's not just tunnels to transport water. It's also the largest ecosystem restoration program that would ever be done in California. So if you don't do this program, not only do you jeopardize water supply reliability, but you also continue to degrade the environment. So not moving forward is a lose-lose, both for the environment and for water supply. Moving forward is a chance to create a win-win if we can get out of the controversy and start making decisions.
Jeffrey Keitlinger, General Manager of Metropolitan Water District, supplying half the water in Southern California. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Andy Lipkus is president and founder of Tree People. That's a group advocating water conservation. Andy Lipkus, good to have you on our program.
It's great to be back with you, Warren.
Let's start where we left off with Jeffrey Keitlinger. How do you feel about the plans that the governor has proposed for this massive project, Bay Delta Project?
Well, it's clear we need a reliable and resilient water supply for the state and for Southern California. And some water needs to come from up north to balance what we can actually develop here. We have been tracking the process, and we feel most aligned with the proposal being generated by the NRDC to have a smaller set of tubes that can, you know, sip when necessary and be part of a mix.
So, obviously, there's going to be controversy about this, and it may come on the ballot sooner rather than later, although there's some doubt the governor wants to put it on the ballot during an election year. In the meantime, what can people in Southern California do, particularly when we just heard from Jeffrey Keitlinger, we've got enough water here for the moment, but they're still calling for reductions. What more can we do to reduce demand?
Well, we can do a lot. We are not clear when this drought is going to end. It could be next week, but we keep pointing to Australia, who just went through a 12-year drought. And the question is, when did they realize it was 12 years instead of two? And what changes in their behavior did they make? We can make decisions now in a sane fashion because we have that reserve. Not spend it down immediately, but immediately begin to shift how we spend our water. So we should definitely do the things that many Southern Californians who lived through the drought in the late 70s, early 80s, from the simple things of even taking shorter showers, not always flushing the toilet for number one, shorter time, just wet your toothbrush while brushing your teeth and shaving. Those acts of conservation are huge, and it's hard for people to believe that. But when we did it as a community way back, you know, people are willing to give it a shot. And what we saw, because it was a good public education campaign run by MWD and the water agencies, we had a public water use thermometer, and we saw very quickly that within a couple weeks, the people of Southern California dropped their use by 30%. Now, that was repeated just a couple years ago in Long Beach when they put in some stiff penalties if you use too much water. They asked people to stop watering their lawns, and immediately they dropped to only 100 gallons per person per day of water use. L.A. is around 132 gallons per person per day, or 123. So, you know, from moving in what you do, what you can do in the home, that really does make a difference, because there's 4 million people in L.A. City, there's 10 million in the county, and then there's more of us in Southern California. all our acts together really, really do add up, and it's incumbent upon the agencies to show that back to people. But we'll be asked, I'm sure, to cut way back in our landscape water use, and in that case, we should cut back on our lawns and then begin to favor the trees that we need to protect and shade our houses, feed us, and protect us. And then we can divert water that we capture in our showers, sinks to them. Gray water is legal in Los Angeles now, that you can connect a hose up to your washing machine and send it out to your garden. That's now legal. You can go on the LA City website or just Google Gray Water LA City, and they have instructions on how to do that legally. So there's actually a fair amount of water that we can save and redirect to our priority needs. Again, it's important to realize, especially as Jeffrey said, that we have some stored water. That does not mean use it up now, because we don't know how long that has to last.
What about the Australians? You just mentioned a 12-year drought, and I understand there was a multi-agency meeting, including the DWP, maybe the MWD as well, with people from Australia. What did they learn from that?
Well, we brought the chief researcher from the Australia Center for Water-Sensitive Cities, Tony Wong, who helped advise Australian governments and the people on how to respond. And we had Xavier Oslovsky, we had the head of water for DWP, Jim McDaniel, the head of the vice president of the DWP board. Jeff couldn't make it. But also, we had the head of the Governor's Drought Commission, Felicia Marcus, all here to learn first about the need to collaborate and coordinate. And so we brought these agencies together so they could begin talking as much as possible before the crisis. The most important thing they learned is the longer you wait, the fewer options you have, the more expensive they are. And so it's important that we begin to work on a short-term, medium-term, and long-term strategy. And, you know, one of the outcomes that was most important for tree people to hear is the choices that we're making, like the BDCP plan, the Bay Delta plan, we recognize that 75% of the energy involved in Los Angeles' water is to lift it over the mountains to bring it here. And yet, the big, big lesson from Australia was it rains even in the drought. And in this one, this past year, the driest on record, it rained only 3.6 inches, but it generated, just for the city of LA, conservatively, 13 billion gallons of water. If that was captured, we would have it for our landscapes, for toilet flushing, and various other critical needs that don't include drinking water. What Australia did that was the biggest story from our perspective, and they have a good story and a negative story. The good story is they gave people rainwater tanks. They incentivized them so they were inexpensive, and people installed them by millions. And they were able to capture the rain that did fall and use it really well. It was like everybody had their own rainwater bank account and insurance policy. And
what's the bad part of the story?
Oh, the bad part was that when the drought was almost over, but nobody knew it, they were still scared, and they invested billions and billions in desal plants. And the drought ended before any of the plants were finished being constructed, and some of them are still not finished. And when they were finished, nobody bought the water.
Okay.
It's more than doubled their water bills. Now, they have an insurance policy. Should the drought come back, those things could be turned on. But the important thing here was that people were able to be equipped quickly to capture water and use it wisely. And when we're looking, you know, this is Which Way LA. We have choices as a people to make of where we're going to invest our billions of dollars. And we have to understand that we could invest locally in building a local supply that is resilient, that is a smart water grid, if you will. If you could imagine a million homes or more, all connected, each with a small 5, 10, 20,000 gallon cistern, electronically networked, that could you could move the water from the north down into them if necessary, but they're here to capture the rain that does fall. So had we...
Okay,
had we
I'm going to interrupt you, Andy Lucas, the president and founder of Tree People, just because we need to cover a couple of other aspects of this dry winter. The fire above Glendora is a prime example of what dry winter weather means for fire danger. Chief Ken Pimlott is director of CAL FIRE. That's part of the State Department of Forestry and Conservation. Chief, good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon.
Tell us how serious this is. I understand one of the problems is that everything is so dry, and because it's the season for Santa Ana winds, the fires are moving faster than they do normally do?
Yeah, absolutely. And, California is no stranger to fires, particularly in Southern California, in the winter months. What's unique and really unprecedented this year is that statewide we are seeing, after 3 years of below normal rainfall, we're seeing fires burning with extreme intensity. Obviously, the fire this week in Los Angeles County, really traditional Santa Ana wind-driven fire, but also even without the wind, the dry fuel, the vegetation, was really fueling that fire to the intensity that we would normally see in August. And obviously what adds to this year is in Northern California, we had a fire in Humboldt County, one of the wettest areas in the country.
Up near the Oregon border.
Correct, and not far from the coast. And it burned over 330 acres in the first week of January. That is very telling for the kinds of conditions we're seeing across the state.
What does this mean for the resources that California devotes to fighting fires? Is it necessary to have more? Are we going to run out? Where are we?
Well, what it means is, of course, we normally staff, our peak staffing normally occurs between May and November, early December. That's our traditional peak fire season months. What this means for us is that we are bringing resources on early to support that additional workload that we would not normally have. So we have about 5,000 permanent personnel, mostly permanent firefighters. We are beginning to hire back seasonal firefighters in Northern California to help supplement that. And then we actually have not laid off many of our seasonal firefighters at all in Southern California because the fire threat has just continued. So again, with the governor's drought declaration, he has really lent his support in that declaration to include the firefighting resources that we need to meet this threat.
So you've been doing this for a long time, trying to deal with fire, or you wouldn't be director of Cal Fire. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Honestly, in my 30-year career as a firefighter, I have not seen conditions like this in the state like this before.
Again, Chief Ken Pilmott is the director of Cal Fire. What does this mean for one of the smoggiest states in the union? Here's Bill Pastert. He's meteorologist at the Jet Propulsion Lab. Always good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren.
A lot of smog out in the Central Valley as well as here in Southern California. To what extent is it increased by the kind of weather we're seeing?
Well, of course, the bad air quality, which has been around for the last couple of months, is very much related to this drought. Stationary high-pressure systems over the American Southwest. Essentially, the only air movement we're getting here, as the chief pointed out, are continuing Santa Anas, which have just dried us out. And, of course, they bring the dusty pollen-filled air from the high desert into the basin here. And the other thing that's related to this, temperatures have been unusually high. And so our normally worst air quality in the country is exacerbated by these high temperatures, ground-level ozone. And the recent fires, of course, that have added many, many small particulates to the air. And so the quality, and then there's a triple whammy here, is that it's the end of January, which, of course, is springtime in Southern California. And so we're already getting tree pollen. And so any way you look at it, people with allergies, asthma, the elderly, young children, air quality has been unusually bad. And needless to say that what we usually count on to clear out the air quality and clear out the air in the basin, rain, has been totally absent. This is going to turn out to be a January with zero rainfall, which I've never seen before.
What about the long-term forecast? How long is this going to go on?
Well, people forget that this drought has been building for more than a decade. And my forecast, of course, is a continuing drought this winter and perhaps many years beyond. Jeff might remember in 2000, I actually forecasted a 20-year drought for California, which, by the way, we have seen many times in the past. And so I wouldn't be too optimistic about getting out of this drought anytime soon.
So when we hear Andy Lipka say that we don't want to spend what we've got now and we better prepare for the future, which both he and Jeffrey Keitlinger were very adamant about, I take it you think that's a good idea.
Absolutely. Is that, by the way, I think we could cut our water usage by 20 or 30% in Southern California without breaking a sweat. You know, most of our water usage is in our yards, and I've cut down to one watering a week, and I have neighbors that are still watering 7 days a week.
Bill Patzert, again, with the Jet Propulsion Lab, where he's the research scientist and meteorologist. Andy Lipka, quickly back to you. The DWP says that Los Angeles already is the biggest the city of a million people that uses the least water per capita of any in the United States. Are people going to get tired of hearing this message?
Well, they might. And, you know, we have done a great job, but we can do a lot more. I agree that most people are using a huge amount more than they need to. We do have to change our landscape some. So there's a lot that we can do, and it won't be that sacrificial.
Okay.
It is time.
Andy Lipka.
And by the way, we're holding workshops on February 1st for people who want to learn how to cut down right away, how to use gray water, how to use native plants and remove their lawns.
Okay. If you're interested in that, once again, Andy Lipka is president and founder of Tree People, and you can go online. Thanks to him. Thanks to Bill Patzert with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Chief Ken Pimlott of CAL FIRE, and our earlier guest, Jeffrey Keitlinger, general manager of the MWD. In a moment, public libraries are getting back into business on Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. One casualty of the Great Recession was $22 million in budget cuts for libraries in the city of Los Angeles. But 4 years ago, voters started reversing the damage with Measure L. First, Monday services were restored. Now, 8 of the system's 72 regional branches and the downtown Central Library are open again on Sundays. Here's the city librarian, John Shabo.
During those really tough times in 2009, 2010, when there were severe cuts to staffing, hours of operation in our libraries, what Measure L did simply is after it passed, over the next 4 years, and we are going to be entering year four of Measure L in July of 2014, is it set in motion incremental increases in the library's budget that allow us to restore all of those important services. So we restored Monday hours. We restored Tuesday and Thursday hours. We restored evenings. And we also have restored dollars to our materials budget that we purchase everything from picture books to bestsellers to e-audiobooks and all of these things.
Librarian John Shabo once again talking with KCRW's arts and culture reporter Lisa Napoli, who joins me in the studio. Hi.
Hi there.
Good to see you.
It's good to see you, and it's always exciting to talk about libraries, one of my favorite subjects.
So books aren't out of date.
Not only are they not out of date, Warren, what was so interested in talking with both the city librarian and the county librarian is that the role of the library is changing. They both said to me the people used to come in 10 years ago to a library, check out a book, and walk out. Now they use the library the way they use a Starbucks. They hang out like a living room. Part of that is more people, of course, are working at home. There are many people who are not working. There are kids who come after school, and they congregate in libraries, which is why it's so important that they be open for longer hours.
Hasn't this been true of libraries since libraries were established? It sounds like Benjamin Franklin again.
Yes, it is. Back to the days of Carnegie and Benjamin Franklin and all the great men who made libraries possible. You know, it's I think that it is a sign of the times, the changing times, especially in a city like LA, that people feel the need to go and hang out, use Wi-Fi. There are, of course, many people who do not have access to computers. Apparently, our libraries, I found out in reporting this story, are major hubs for immigrants to come and learn about gaining citizenship. Of course, there's a new program that's starting where you can go and get your high school diploma. online through the library systems. There's their hubs of literacy. So they've just changed and morphed. What's also interesting is that more and more people are borrowing digital resources from their libraries. So in some ways, it almost doesn't even matter, although I shouldn't say that, if a library is open. You can sit in your pajamas at 3 o'clock in the morning and download audiobooks, ebooks, more than ever. Those are
from the library.
From the library, from your home. The county librarian, Margaret Donnellan Todd, told me that if you were to calculate how many assets are borrowed virtually, that ranks number 4 in terms of the borrowing power of a brick and mortar library, which is incredible. More and more people are using it that way.
Did the county libraries take the same kind of hit that the city libraries did?
They didn't this time around. They had a different sort of hit, and part of that has to do with the complexity of how their finances are, because it is such a broad system. As broad as the L.A. city system is, the county system is far wider, and it relates somehow in ways to the way charter schools are. In some communities, the wealthier communities, they can raise money that offset the losses of the budget cutbacks that they're apparently, it was uneven in how it was affected, so it's hard to summarize. But even though they did in some places have to cut down, they didn't have the mass cutbacks that we saw in the city.
With the libraries open on Sundays, are people going there instead of going to church?
That I couldn't tell you. I wonder, it's sort of like the Prohibition era, the dry laws, if you will. I do know that last Sunday when the L.A. City Library opened, apparently people just rushed right in as soon as they had the ribbon cutting because they're that excited about using the assets there. They just need them.
And there really is an issue in this era of income disparity. About that, it seems to me, and to make these kinds of resources available to more and more people who don't have computers, don't have smartphones necessarily, is really important.
Yes. And at the same time, people who do have the means, who do have Wi-Fi, or kids after school, one of the biggest problems with the closure of the libraries over the last few years has been kids not having places to go after school. So especially in our more troubled neighborhoods here in L.A., they've been seen as hubs, neutral hubs for kids. So, yeah, they're good for the people who really need the money don't have the money, but they're also good for the people who do. People bring their children there from the very beginning of their lives to learn a love of books, and it's a great equalizer. They go as families, yeah.
All right,
the L.A. Public Library, you see it all the time. It's beautiful.
A good news story, something we are always running short of.
Yes.
Good to hear from you again, KCRW's arts and culture reporter Lisa Napoli. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.